Good afternoon. I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Davids, would you like to approve the minutes? All in favor of minutes, say by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes have been approved. The first bill up today on the agenda is House File 2177, Representative Ward. She's coming up, and the chair moves House File 2177 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Welcome, Representative Ward. I see you have no
thank
amendments.
You, Madam Chair and Committee, thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, in this bill, there is a penalty defined. This bill creates a misdemeanor, and if they a petty misdemeanor, and if they actually take the fine language out and just declare it as a petty misdemeanor, then the court sets those fines by the normal operation, then it wouldn't need to come and see my committee. So if they're interested in taking out the dollar amount fines, it could just go to the general register.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom. We would be happy to do that, make that change.
How are we going to do that? We have to make that change. All right, thank you.
You ready?
So, and Mr. Pender?
Would that be just for...
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I believe that on line 2.15, if you add a period after the word petty misdemeanor, and delete line 2.16 and 2.17, you would take care of the issue.
Do you have that, Representative Ward? Would you repeat that, please?
On line 2.15, if you would put a period after the word petty misdemeanor, and then delete line 2.16 and 2.17, then it wouldn't need to come to us.
Great. Thank you very much. Yes, I would
agree. Any questions to the oral amendment members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. So if it's a petty misdemeanor, who then would determine what the fine or penalty would be?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the court puts together the payables list, and they rank all of the petty misdemeanors. They set the fine amounts, and it's just by the normal course of court action.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Representative Dean, is it okay? Any other questions, members, to that oral amendment? If none, I'll signify an approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, the oral amendment has been adopted. Representative Ward, to your bill as amended.
As amended. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, and thank you for hearing this bill. I think that we're all pretty sun deprived right now, third week into session, and really longing for spring and summer. Kids are also wanting to be in the sun, and short of that, have a history of tanning. We are bringing forth a bill to address a very dangerous practice, and basically what we're doing is going to prohibit minors from using indoor tanning facilities, require proprietors to hang a sign to that effect, and impose penalties to that effect. And why now? Prom's coming up, and all sorts of temptations to have a healthy glow by using tanning, particularly because in Minnesota it's going to be a while before we can actually have the natural effect. But skin cancer is the most common cancer and is largely preventable. The incidence of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer, has more than doubled since 1995 among young women alone. In Minnesota, more than 1,200 new cases of melanoma are diagnosed every year. 127 Minnesotans will die of this disease every year. Research has conclusively linked indoor tanning to increased risk of melanoma, especially among children. And we have testifiers, if you have questions, who would explain how that works and why. We're fortunate to have people who will help explain the research and why tanning beds have been classified as a class 1 carcinogen, the same as cigarettes. We can summarize the state data on melanoma and tanning among the, teens, and it's profound. The effect is coming from our own, the effort is coming from our own medical community and is supported by American Cancer Society Action Network. Matt Schaefer is here to help answer your questions as well. The University of Minnesota Masonic Cancer Center, Minnesota Dermatological Society, Minnesota Medical Association, Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, Minnesota Cancer Alliance, Melanoma Awareness, Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Metro Minnesota Oncology Nursing Society, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, a line of hospitals and clinics, and the Mayo Clinic. Parental permission is not good enough. It doesn't work. The data demonstrates that we're not doing enough to protect our children. Tanning beds are in the same class as cigarettes and asbestos. Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Schaefer has a couple of comments, and then we would be ready for questions.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Schaefer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The 1.1 put out to the committee was in the House Health and Human Services Policy Committee. The committee was able to adopt an amendment that came at the request of the American Tanning Association that just made sure that this legislation was not going to inadvertently capture other products that happen to be on the market, for example, materials for spray tans, lotions for creating artificial tans, other products that I didn't know existed on the market prior to this. And so to make sure we were staying true to the integrity of the bill, after accepting that amendment, the American Tanning Association came out in support of our bill. We'd like to thank them for working with us on this legislation to try to achieve what we believe is peace in the valley. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you. Members, do we have any questions for either the testifier or the bill author? Anyone in the audience want to testify for or against? Seeing none, I then will. Thank you, Representative Ward. And the chair moves then that House File 2177, as amended, be referred to the General Register. And thank you for your time and
thank
your
you
bill.
Very much.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
Little incentive.
Oh.
And thanks.
Well, thank you. We'll take them.
Can I leave? Oh, yes.
Next up is Representative Halverson.
Did we start? Well, we decided not to.
He's vaping right now before they ban it.
We don't want to be accused of driving.
He's a bad dude.
He's vaping and panning.
Crap, I thought you were.
No, I know.
Welcome to the committee. And then Representative Halverson. Representative Halverson moves House File 1931 be re-referred to the General Register. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This bill before us today is regarding electronic cigarette regulation in Minnesota. Currently, there is no electronic cigarette regulation in Minnesota, and it's because this product is so new, and frankly, the utilization of it has just exploded within the last year, as has numerous businesses that are selling these products. And because of that, local governments are coming to a number of us in the legislature and asking for some more guidance on how these are to be regulated. And so that was the impetus for this particular bill. Because this issue is new and emerging, I'd ask the committee to just allow me a few minutes to provide some background on the e-cigarettes issue. And then we have a couple of testifiers to hear from. E-cigarettes, by definition, are a drug delivery device. They're designed to deliver nicotine via a heated liquid that's inhaled and exhaled. Nicotine, as we all know, is one of the most addictive substances known to humans. Anybody who knows anybody who's tried to quit smoking has personal experience with that. But the medical community and researchers put nicotine addiction on par with heroin addiction in the way that your brain reacts to it. And that is what makes it so hard and so significant of an addiction problem. E-cigarettes currently have no industry standards for production, either at the federal, state, or local level. And so
Some e-cigarette products are coming from overseas, from China. A lot of them are being manufactured here, but with no industry standards, so the user doesn't know what's in them. And that's significant because a lot of discussion around e-cigarettes is about how safe they really are. And with no industry standard, the consumer really doesn't know how safe they are. One of the most significant findings is that the CDC has found that e-cigarette vapors contain heavy metals like mercury and other harmful lead, and also diethylene glycol, which is antifreeze, formaldehyde. In addition, of course, they contain nicotine, and the nicotine levels that the CDC has studied in e-cigarettes are very frequently different than what is advertised, and so there is an assumption that the user can control how much nicotine they're getting based on what the manufacturer is saying, and the CDC is actually finding out that that's not true. Those nicotine levels are not found to be consistent with what's being advertised. E-cigarettes are not a stop smoking device. That's a very important to note. E-cigarette manufacturers, in particular the big tobacco companies that make these, have sued the FDA to make it clear that they are not a stop smoking device so that they do not have to go through any testing on efficacy or safety. And they have not found to be safe. As I said, the FDA has found concerns with them. And finally, and the reason I bring this bill forward, is that e-cigarettes are popular among our children. In 1 year, the use of e-cigarettes in people under 18 doubled, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And that's for a very specific reason. They are being marketed pretty aggressively toward kids using standards that we know the tobacco industry has used to market to children, specifically flavors. They come in flavors like bubblegum and gummy bear, and they can be used, and they use cartoon characters. You can buy a Hello Kitty vaping device and vape with your Hello Kitty vaping device with your bubblegum flavored vape. So they're very kid friendly. I had a group of high school students in my office just yesterday, and they were very interested in this bill because they're seeing a lot of use in high schools and a lot of use among their friends, people who have never smoked before, people who have never been exposed to indoor smoking. This is a generation that's growing up without indoor smoking, and they're seeing an explosion of use among their peers. And I said, why do people use these? And they said, because they taste good. So clearly these folks know their audience, and they're hooking kids early. It's significant because, as I said, nicotine is incredibly addictive. And so this bill targets the sales and use for among children for the most part. And I can just walk through the provisions so it's real clear what is in this bill and what's not in this bill.
Thank you.
First of all, there is one indoor smoking provision that's in this bill. It's quite limited. It prohibits indoor use under any state building that's under the direction of the Department of Administration. So it's a pretty narrow scope of government buildings. This building is included because there's been individual directions that have had to be given because vaping has happened right here within these walls. Tobacco products under Section 2 are prohibited tobacco products are prohibited in public schools. We add e-cigarettes to that definition as well. So they're not going to be in the teacher's lounge, and there will be consequences for kids who use them in public schools. We go on to allow local units of government to license these products as tobacco-related devices and similar products, and so that local governments can license, because they're going to end up doing compliance checks just like they do with cigarettes in sales. It makes it explicitly clear you may not sell to minors. And it also makes it clear that if you're selling these products in a facility that's not an adult-only facility, the products cannot be sitting out with the gum and the candy bars on your shelves. It has to be behind the counter. And it can't be sold in vending machines just like cigarettes. Additionally, it expands the definition of tobacco in terms of sale of tobacco to children to include e-cigarettes, extends the penalty of selling e-cigarettes to minors, and creates a petty misdemeanor for those who do sell e-cigarettes to minors. As I said, minors are getting their hands on these things, so I think it's incumbent upon us to make it crystal clear that these are not allowed among children. And that's pretty much the bill. It's got a lot of broad-based support among health coalitions as well as the League of Minnesota Cities. Happy to answer any questions, or we can hear from our testifiers.
Well, thank you, Representative Halverson. But I see you do have an amendment.
I do have an amendment.
Do you want to move that amendment?
I would like to move the A7 amendment, Madam Chair.
Any questions to the amendment, members? Seeing none, all in favor of the A7 amendments, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes. The amendment has been adopted. I see you have some testifiers. Do you want to bring them down? And
yes, please, Madam Chair. I'd like to invite Commissioner Ellinger to join me at the table.
Good. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. State your name and proceed with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here to talk about e-cigarettes and support this bill that will put some restrictions on where they can be used and to whom they can be sold. Without going through all of the testimony that provided to the Health Committee, I would really break to comment on some of the things related to the jurisdiction of this committee. And as you know, tobacco use is a huge problem in our society. It's the number one public health problem, and it comes from the addictive nature of nicotine and the chemicals that then come with the tobacco smoke and the problems that that causes. And one of the things that we're talking about with e-cigarettes is the fact that this is a relatively new product. It really came about in 2007. And as the representative said, it was purposely not put forward as a cessation device because it would then not be under the regulation of the Food and Drug Administration. So because of that, we don't know a lot about what goes into e-cigarettes. Currently, they're not regulated by FDA, and there are more than 300 manufacturers of e-cigarettes, and there are no regulations, so no consistency in the product from one to another. The labeling that we have done, that has been done with e-cigarettes, has shown to be quite variable. There's a lot of inaccuracies in that, including claims of being nicotine-free and when actually nicotine has been there. The quality control processes for producing e-cigarettes are very variable, and the quality control is quite limited. So there is no guarantee in the consistency in how much nicotine is in each cigarette or e-cigarette or what other chemicals are there. And often the vaping solutions are actually made up in the stores where the distribution goes. So we really don't know what goes on there. So there's a quality control issue for a chemical, with nicotine, which is a very powerful chemical. So the potential health risks of e-cigarettes remain undetermined. However, as was pointed out, we have known there are carcinogens and toxins that have been found in e-cigarettes and in some of the vapor emitted from these e-cigarettes. It's an untested product without proper regulation with multiple varieties on the market, so we really don't know what's there. I'm particularly concerned relative to your committee is about that nicotine in high doses can be very toxic, and we've seen an increase in calls to poison control centers for nicotine toxicity, mostly because children have been ingesting the solutions, the product, and so we have under the age of five, a lot of nicotine toxicity has been there. Also, as pointed out, that these have been really marketed to children and adolescents. As we were saying, the flavors of gummy bear and chocolate and fruit punch. Also getting celebrity endorsements. And young people are really vulnerable to those environmental influences, so that restricting these and having youth access is really, reducing youth access is really important. But we know that despite some of the concerns that we have, the use of e-cigarettes by adolescents has gone up dramatically, has doubled between 2011 and 2012. And a recent article just last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association has shown that use of e-cigarettes by adolescents was associated with more associated, the e-cigarette users will be smokers. that they're more likely to begin smoking once they start using an e-cigarette. They'll be less likely to quit smoking from a conventional cigarette if they are e-smokers. And e-cigarettes does not discourage adolescents from quitting smoking, actually encourages them to continue smoking because of the dual use. So there's no body of evidence that that they are actually also work for as a cessation, because a lot of people will bring up the fact that they are used, and they may work on an individual basis, but we just don't know. But the studies that I've seen starting to come out show that they really are not as in an effective cessation product. And it also undermines people's ability to quit, under their attempts to quit, by saying the dual use, using e-cigarettes in places where I can't smoke, and then using tobacco in places where I can use tobacco. And sometimes they're offered, generally the thought is, well, are there a safer alternative to tobacco? And that encourages people to continue using them as a safer alternative, and keeps them from really reducing their nicotine dependence and using things that have been shown to be effective. So I believe that the state, for a public health perspective, has a responsibility to act, because e-cigarettes use, they, which mimic many times conventional cigarette uses, would make it more difficult to enforce the Freedom to Breathe Act. There's no evidence that shows that the vapor that's emitted is safe to inhale, and we really do need to reduce the use of unregulated products that have such addictive capabilities as nicotine. So with this, I believe that, that there should be some restrictions placed on e-cigarettes. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And do you have another testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair. Molly Moylan from Clearway, Minnesota.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity today to testify in favor of House File 1931. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I am the Director of Public Affairs at Clearway, Minnesota. We are a nonprofit working to reduce tobacco's harm in Minnesota. I am appearing today on behalf of a coalition of organizations that support this legislation. They include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the Association for Nonsmokers Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, the Minnesota Medical Association, and many others. All these organizations helped in the fight to pass the Freedom to Breathe Act back in 2007. I know that Section 1, the clean indoor air portion of this bill, was stripped out earlier in session. However, a full understanding of this issue requires a discussion of smoke-free law, which today is one of the most popular policies that our state has ever seen. In fact, every survey since 2007 has found it growing more popular, with the most recent poll showing an 87% approval rating. These days, what other state policy has an approval rating like that? Now, health in Minnesota is benefiting from Freedom to Breathe. Studies have found decreases in carcinogens, heart attacks, and secondhand smoke exposure directly attributed to the law. Now, the public wants e-cigarettes added to the law. A new poll found that 79% of Minnesotans support prohibiting e-cigarette use in places where smoking is already prohibited. That's a huge number. And an even larger number, 87%, support keeping e-cigarettes behind the counter in stores. The Freedom to Breathe Act was meant to protect everyone's right to breathe clean indoor air. Workers, the elderly, people with compromised immune systems. Now, I'm a mother of a new six-month-old, and when someone lights up an e-cigarette in a restaurant and starts blowing clouds of vapor around, I get really nervous because we just don't know what's in it. When the law was written, e-cigarettes were only just beginning to appear in Minnesota. Its authors couldn't have imagined a time where they would be used to get around the law. This legislature can easily correct this loophole and show it understands the importance of clean indoor air that the law protects. The public support demonstrates that the proposal before you makes sense. E-cigarette use is rising, and people do not want them to encroach on the clean air they have enjoyed for almost 7 years now. I urge you to support this legislation, and I'd also just like to point out a number of the documents that were just passed out, including a letter of support from the League of Minnesota Cities, a letter of support from the City of Minneapolis, a letter of support from students from St. Paul, as well as a packet of information that includes the poll data that I just discussed.
Thank you for your testimony. And I believe we have one other testifier, Cap Roar.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. O'Rourke, state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cap O'Rourke, and I am representing the Independent Vaping Retailers of Minnesota. My organization is a group of small business owners, manufacturers, retailers, and distributors based in Minnesota that sell these products and solutions. They are not tobacco companies. We do not manufacture or distribute tobacco products, but we work almost exclusively in the vaping industry. My clients are we share the author's concern and working to prevent access to these products to underage people under the age of 18. There is currently, as this bill addresses, a gap in regulation, and most of all my shops currently adhere to that and would like to see this regulation more clarity passed, especially with regards to local municipalities. There are currently, some of my owners have shops in two municipalities, and there is confusion and differentiating opinions between the municipalities of whether or not you need a license, you don't need a license, what type of license. So in the efforts that this bill does to create this kind of explain this better to some of the local cities and communities, we support that. One area of concern that I would just bring up on page 5, lines 5.4 through 5.22 is the definition of electronic delivery device. My clients don't have really any concern with this definition, although it should be pointed out that on line 5.17 it says electronic delivery device includes any component, part of a product, whether or not marketed or sold separately. There are batteries in some of these products, and these batteries, some of these batteries are used exclusively for vaping products, but some of them are not. So in the way that this is written, if someone were to sell a battery if a Batteries Plus were to sell one of these batteries to a 16-year-old to be used in a device not intended to be used for a vaping product, but to be for their computer or flashlight, or I don't know what the batteries are all used for, then according to this bill, they would be in violation of selling to a minor. And so I think this can be cleared up. I just kind of wanted to point it out. That it's the way they define it, we use it all with components that are used in these vaping products, it could leave some level of confusion and ambiguity, but I think it can be fixed.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Halverson. Any words?
Yes, Madam Chair, in regard to that, I know that concern was brought to me today, and it's certainly something that we can work with. I've asked some researchers to take a peek at how we could make it exclusive to the e-cigarette devices, and so it would be very clear in statute. So Batteries Plus would not be on the hook.
Okay, good. Thank you. Anybody else? Members, do you have any questions to this bill or to this testifier? I don't see any. Anyone in the audience want to testify for or against this? I don't see any movement. All right. I'm going to make a motion then, Representative Halverson, to move House File 1931 to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Bill is on its way.
Next up is House File 1984. Representative Sundin moves that House File 1984 be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Representative Sundin, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here in Minnesota, we have the right to refuse to use certain vendors or services in our own homes, and we can take a look at the track record of some of these contractors and some of these people that we might invite into our homes, and we have some resources like Angie's List and Craig's List to examine the track record of any contractors or vendors, anybody that we choose to do business with, and it seems to be working out quite well. What the state of Minnesota does not have is a list of their own. So if there's a contractor with a poor performance record, in any aspect, it could be a labor issue, it could be a quality control issue, it could be any number of things that would affect the performance of that contractor vendor, and I think this bill is going to help rectify that situation. So when the state of Minnesota can compile a list and back check and make certain they have responsible bidders providing goods and services for the state of Minnesota. Today I have Kyle Makarios with the North Central States Region Council of Carpenters to go through the bill, and Harry Melander with Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council to testify for it as well. So if I can, I can bring down Kyle Makarios and go through the bill.
Oh. Or Mr. Makarios is better looking younger brother.
Yeah.
Perhaps. And Representative Sundin, I just wanted to say on behalf of, and I think members of the committee have probably heard the same, my understanding is that the proponents and opponents of the bill have been having some good conversations and are still in the process of working some good stuff out. I'm assuming members on both sides have started to pick up that as well. So, Mr. Melander, we'd love to have you sort of walk through the bill, but our main goal today, I think, is to not get in the way of both sides trying to find that, as Representative Davids likes to say, that peace in the valley that we're all looking to find. So don't say anything inflammatory, Melander, okay?
Well put, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm employed by the Minnesota State Council of Carpenters as their chair. Mr. Makarios was also going to be here with me and go through the bill, it's across the street, and they're working through some things.
And for our purposes, Mr. Melander, we just really need the highlights. Most of our members are pretty up-to-date on what the bill does. They read through it before they get here. So,
I'll try to be respectful of your time and not make it so simplistic, but what this bill does is it provides an opportunity within the public bidding law for municipalities, purchasing agencies, a different option or a tool that doesn't exist right now under the public bidding law. And what it does is that it just asks contractors or subcontractors to fill out an affidavit and say that they have not violated any of the items that's listed in the bill. Simple. It's no fiscal note. It's provided to the contracting agency. The reason why we're doing this is that what we have found is that in some of our smaller municipalities, smaller school districts, we continue to see individuals that participate in these publicly funded projects that because of the bidding laws now, they're there. There's nothing those municipalities can do. And this really just says if, in fact, you're not playing by the rules, that you're not a legitimate contractor, that they shouldn't use our money and yours.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. And I think we'll hold for questions for a moment. We've also got, I believe, a representative. I've got Phil Raines down, but I think we may have other people talking on behalf of the contractor. Is there anybody else that desires to be heard? Sure. Or perhaps a couple people that desire to be heard. So, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association and also the Minnesota Contractors, who are members of the National Electrical Contractors Association. These are all about 300 subcontractors who are all union hiring contractors. We support the basic principles of this bill. We think this is a good bill. We do have some concerns that we're working on in regards to the dollar threshold and the due process issue, but we think this bill is going in the right direction, and we support it.
Thank you. All right. Don't mess with this. Who's up next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just my name is Matt Marquis. I represent 80 different subcontractors in the drywall, flooring, thermal insulation, mechanical insulation areas. We are working on the problems, as the chair indicated, that we see in the bill, and we're pretty close to an agreement in principle, I would say. So please pass this on.
Great. Thank you. Raines?
Good afternoon.
You're batting cleanup. Don't strike out.
All right. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for taking the testimony. Just got out of the same bill over in the Senate. I appreciate you guys taking the time to look at this bill. We have significant concerns with the bill, catching up responsible contractors that get tripped up by minor violations, people that are trying to comply with the law, but through sometimes the crazy application of the law, sometimes through calculation in this error, they voluntarily make back payments, making sure that those payments go out to workers as quickly as possible. The system works pretty well that way right now. Right now there are 19 people or 19 companies that have been debarred by the state for willful or repeated violations. And we think that's the proper standard to have out there. Breaking news, that amendment was just adopted in the Senate. This House obviously makes its own decisions on how those are done. But we're thankful that the bill is moving in the right direction. We'd like to work with the authors to make sure that this does weed out the bad actors, but does not trip up the good, responsible people that are trying to comply with the law.
Thank you, Mr. Rain. Is there anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to the bill? Well, Mr. Raines, I guess you weren't quite cleanup. We've got, who would it be? Who hit fifth for the Twins? Justin Renault, maybe? I don't know. Yes, sir. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Warkey. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I'm going to be very brief because you've heard some of those comments, and I'm coming from the same hearing and it's been a similar bill in the Senate. But for purposes of the committee's understanding, our membership is principally 85% union contractors. We maintain the relationship with our partners in the building trades as union contractors. The bill in front of you, as you've heard, is a work in progress. I'm here to give you a status report, as others have, that we feel we're making some significant progress and some inroads about many of the concerns you've probably heard about already today. I won't go into those. I'm hopeful that we're going to reach an accord on this with our partners, and we'll be able to say that our concerns have been met with respect to the bill, and that is the full extent of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Warkey. Anyone else? Then just from, unless members have other ideas, from a process standpoint, normally what we would do, quite frankly, when we didn't have a bill that's quite ready for the floor, we'd stop it here. Give it pause, wait till it comes back with the amendment, because I think all members of this committee hold both sides of this debate in such high regard. What I'd recommend that we do is move it along to the next committee. There's been assurance from both sides, I think pretty steady assurance from the past six testifiers, that they're very close to having that final language. Reserving the right for Representative Hoppe as the minority lead and myself to pull the bill back to this committee if it falls out of bed. And Representative Sundin will obviously look for your guidance there. But we're hoping to hear back from you that brought it all together and it the amendment be taken up, I guess it would be in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Unless people have reservations about doing that or if members have questions or concerns, then Representative Sundin will renew his motion that House File 1984 be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sundin. And thank you to everyone who came across the street to testify in our hearing. Members, with your indulgence, I have a bill up. I believe it's in the Property Tax Division. Normally we'd hear non-members' bills first. In this case, if you don't mind, I'd like to have my bills heard, and then I'm going to take off. Representative Tice has been kind enough. I think Representative Fritz is going to chair for a couple of these. And then, Representative Tice, are you okay with I asked if you'd chair the remainder of the meeting after my bills are done. Is that okay?
That's fine.
All right. So, Patty, we'll let you chair this next little section, and then Representative Tice will take over from there.
Who do you say?
Yes, you.
That's just mean.
Oh, good. Okay.
We don't want to.
Okay. All right. Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill, House File 2482?
I would be happy to. I'll move House File 2482 be recommended or re-referred, I'm sorry, to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy.
And all right. And no amendments?
No amendments, Madam Chair. There is one testifier, Mr. Peterson, from the Minnesota Gambling Control Board.
All right.
And as he's coming down, I will give a brief overview of it.
Okay.
It simply says, and I'm it's almost quicker to read the language itself.
Okay.
We'd make it a crime under Minnesota law if a person does any of the following, and what we're adding is if they knowingly tamper with or attempt to alter any component or device used in the conduct or play of electronic pull tabs, or if they have unauthorized possession of electronic pull tab device, an electronic linked bingo device, or other components of those devices. The reason we're doing this, quite frankly, is because Minnesota law hasn't quite kept up with the technology, and so we didn't have this on the books. We thought it might make sense. Normally, it would go directly probably to the Judiciary Committee, but because this committee has jurisdiction with respect to gaming, we thought it best make a stop here first. And with that, I've got Mr. Peterson here from the Gambling Control Board as well.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm the licensing supervisor with the Gambling Control Board. As Representative Atkins said, laws and or the technology and the industry of this are still somewhat apart on each other. This was originally supposed to be part of electronic pull tabs. When it was passed, it was just overlooked. We have bipartisan support on this. We don't see any controversy involved with it. It's just to make sure to provide integrity to the games, to the players, and protection to the industry.
Very good. Any questions, members, for this testifier or the author? Seeing none. Anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against? No movement. All right. Representative Atkins, we will move House File 2482 to be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The bill is on its way.
Thank
Representative
you,
Atkins,
Chair.
Do you want to go to your other bill?
Why don't we do 2577, if that's all right,
okay.
Madam Chair?
All right. Okay, Representative Atkins moves that House File 2577 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2577, authored by myself and Representative Hoppe, does two things. One, in the spirit of the unsession, it simply repeals a section that's referenced that is obsolete and really does nothing anymore. And purposes of full disclosure, this may also end up being the vehicle bill that we place all of the other various liquor bills into. That's all there is to it, Madam Chair.
All right. Any questions, members? Seeing none. Representative Atkins renews his motion that House File 2577 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nay. The ayes have it. Okay, for laying over. All right. House File 2720, Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, with Representative Hoppe's co-authorship, House File 2720 is with respect to the All-Star Game. Minnesota has the unique opportunity this summer to host the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. The last time we held an event like this was the Republican National Convention, where we had this sort of significance. Public safety, City of Minneapolis, a variety of others, bars, liquor stores, restaurants, and others, came and towards the end of session suggested that closing hours ought to be extended from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. Honestly, initially my reaction to that was not a good one. I thought, boy, doesn't this just going to contribute to a problem? Maybe people get drink more and wouldn't be a good idea. What public safety folks, law enforcement testified to back then was they actually thought it would aid in public safety. And the point that they made then and the point that I'm making today is a simple one, that it actually, as you extend those closing hours it, for purposes of crowd control, and I see others who've heard the same things from law enforcement, apparently it helps. So all this does, it doesn't require any bar to stay open an extra 2 hours. It's only two nights during the All-Star Game, the night, I believe, of the Home Run Derby, and the second one would be the actual All-Star Game. So that's Monday night into Tuesday morning and then Tuesday night into Wednesday morning would allow, at the discretion of the city or any city in Hennepin County, to allow their bars to stay open an extra couple hours if their public safety folks think it's a good idea. I have the reason I brought this up at this time, Madam Chair, is because obviously the liquor bill is moving through or will be moving through in the next week or two. I didn't want to see this sort of discussion happening on the House floor where this committee, which is charged with jurisdiction over liquor-related issues, didn't have a chance to give it some thought and consideration that it deserves. So I've reached out to folks. I'm looking forward to their testimony. The City of Minneapolis in particular, I've asked them to share their opinion. I think they're represented here today. Mm-hmm. I'd also be interested in hearing from any bars or restaurants that might be interested in it and see what their concerns are.
Well, thank you, Representative Atkins, but I'm going to also move your bill, which we did not do. So we will move House File 2720 to be laid over for the possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I also see you have an A1 amendment.
I do, and that was just an error. We initially indicated 12 p.m., and it should be 12 a.m. Uh-huh. So that's an author's amendment. I would move the A1 amendment.
So they can stay open all afternoon?
All in favor of the A1 amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has been adopted. And you have a testifier, I believe. On this. Mr. Rainier?
Oh. I think there's a couple of folks that want to weigh in, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. The city has not adopted a position on this bill, but we like the idea of local control. Mm-hmm. We, like all cities in Hennepin County, will have the ability to evaluate if it would work in our city. Mm-hmm. We are already in the planning stages for the All-Star Game, and actually the All-Star Game is more, as Representative Atkins said, it's more than just a game now. It's a couple-day event. It starts with the Home Run Derby on Monday night, the All-Star Game itself on Tuesday night. We've been working closely with the Major League Baseball and the Twins and our downtown community, and we will bring this issue and discuss it with our city council. But at this point, we have not made a decision on extending hours to 4 o'clock in the morning.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony. And you have one more testifier. Mr. Bagnoli. Welcome. State your name for the tape and proceed, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli on behalf of Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. I'm just... appreciate Representative Chair Atkins bringing forward this bill. The first time, actually it wasn't the first time, I think they did this for the Super Bowl a number of years ago, but it was done, as Representative Atkins said, for the RNC, and the dollar figure was set at $2,500, which proved to be a number that was almost every bar that did it felt that number was way too high. Didn't make any money and lost a lot of money as a result. So we would suggest that dollar figure come down a fair amount before it goes before. I think that the idea behind it to allow people to stay open, the city is going to make a fair amount of money off the sales proceeds that will more than recoup whatever extra law enforcement that's needed for it. So we believe that the $2,500 figure is a tad high, but appreciate the sentiment and the idea. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for your. Anyone else wish to testify? See none. Members' questions? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Atkins. So I've heard the Republican National Convention mentioned a couple times. I'm assuming we're not expecting protests during the All-Star Game, are we?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I don't know what happens in Minneapolis. Anything is possible, I guess. No, I would hope not.
Oh, any other questions, members?
You know, actually, Madam Chair, I have one question, and
yes.
I don't know who would have the answer. I guess maybe Mr. McCormick. It just dawned on me as I listened to the testimony, whether or not we would be able to figure out how much sales tax was brought in during the RNC. We literally used the $2,500 figure for the permit because we drew that from the last time that we did this. I don't know, and Mr. Ranieri, if he has a point of view with respect to it. I have no idea if it should be $50 or if it should be $5,000. But at this point, we've heard from the bar owners or a representative for the bar owners saying that figure proved to be considerably higher than perhaps what revenue they brought in. This, to me, isn't about bringing in additional revenue as much as it is about, you know, the event itself, people enjoying the event, and then what public safety attested to last time, and that it actually contributes to and improves public safety. So I'm all ears if there is some input that people have with respect to what that fee ought to be that cities can charge if folks want this permit. I'd be more than happy to listen to that.
Okay, Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins. I think the way that it's worded, and we've talked about this or at least touched on it, not to exceed $2,500. I think then Mr. Ranieri and the city can come up with their bar owners. They can decide whatever's going to work for them and what the bar owners are comfortable with and what the city's comfortable with and everybody else in Hennepin County. We're all about local control and baseball.
And baseball. Yeah. Yeah, we did this for football. We've done this for political people. The least we ought to do, Madam Chair, is do it for baseball fans.
Go Twins. All right. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Any other questions, members? None. Okay. Well, with that, Representative Atkins renews his motion that House File 2720, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Please, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Why am I doing that? I'm gavel happy. I'm out of here. Thank you. And Representative Tiss is coming up.
I was waiting for that.
Do you want me to go next or Leon? And I don't see her here. We can do Clark's bill, too.
Clark yet, so.
Can we just do hers?
I think she wanted to come down.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll
almost all of them.
So, here's my
I have a series of questions for the chair.
Representative Hoppe moves that House File 2610 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And people always say this, but this is a simple bill. All we're doing is changing the number of times that samples can be offered from 5 to 12 to coincide with one a month. And if anybody has any more complicated questions than that, I have a guest.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
This is Colin Marsh from Almeida Public Affairs testifying on behalf of Anheuser-Busch Companies.
Do you have any testimony to give?
Oh, no. I'm actually here to, I think Representative Hoppe covered the bill, but I'm here to answer questions. Basically, this bill is a one-word change in current law. Current law allows retail establishments to offer 5 samples per brewer per year. This change would change this 5 sample limit to 12. And essentially, the purpose of this change is to bring Minnesota law up to date with the diversity in the current marketplace. There's been a huge expansion in the options we have with different beers, and this is an attempt to provide consumers with these sampling opportunities.
And Madam Chair, on the heels of it's a one-word simple bill change, I will also offer the phrase, I'm not aware of any opposition.
Okay. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hoppe. Do you know why the original statute was set at 5?
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dean. I honestly don't, and Representative Atkins has left. Maybe Mr. McCormick might remember, but I think we did that 7, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, Mr. McCormick. I don't recall.
Mr. McCrory?
Actually, Mr. Chair, members, I think it's been there quite a bit longer than 7 or 8 years ago, and I think the purpose was basically to start getting into the business of sampling, so try it out at 5.
Representative Hoppe?
I'll go along with that.
Okay.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So,
Representative Dean?
So you're asking for a 240% increase?
Representative Hoppe?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, no, we're asking for once a month.
Representative Dean?
Madam Chair, I'll stop my questioning at this point.
Okay. Keep it simple.
Are there no further questions? Then Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 2610 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Next up is 2710.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will move House File 2710 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. I have a guest here to explain the bill in more detail. This one is slightly more complicated, but essentially not very complicated either. And with that, I'll turn it over.
Okay, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Restaurant Association. Thank you, Representative Hoppe, for authoring this. It includes four changes to 348 of the state liquor law, two of them contained in Section 1. One will be familiar to the committee. Last year, we brought a proposal to change a requirement. Current law has said that a city that has issued a 3-2 beer license and a wine license may allow the sale of strong beer if an establishment had 60% of their sales from the sales of food. You changed that for Minneapolis and St. Paul last year, and there were comments in the committee that that change should be statewide. The Department of Public Safety agrees with that, and the first part of Section 1 makes that change. The second part, the definition of wine in 348.101 has for a long time been alcoholic beverage made generally from fruit of up to 24% alcohol. In the section that defined a wine license, it allowed the sale of wine up to 14% alcohol. For many years, that wasn't a problem. Two things have happened in the market. One is the popularity of sake, which is rice wine, and popular in sushi restaurants and other Japanese ethnic restaurants. And there are no longer sakes available at 14%. The lowest alcohol is about 17%, the average about 19%. And so it is a problem for small neighborhood restaurants, may not qualify for a full spirits license, or it may be more expensive than a small seating capacity qualifies for. And so we are asking to change, to make the definition for the license consistent with the definition of wine in 348. The other change is a little more interesting. For many years, red wines made both in France, in California, and Oregon were typically 13% alcohol. Because of very warm weather, which one can attribute to any cause you may want to attribute it to, the sugar content of red grapes, particularly Zinfandels and Cabernets, have been very high since 2010. And to create a wine that met the dryness standards of palates, alcohol in particularly reds is now above 14%. So most good California Cabernets and Zinfandels can no longer be sold on a wine license. And we think that isn't consistent or what people want. And so that's why the second provision would change the maximum wine content on a wine license to the same definition of wine in the law at 24%. That does not include fortified wines. They're in a different definition, so it would only be naturally occurring alcohols. The second portion of the bill makes lawful practices that have been going on for a very long time. Many of you have seen containers behind bars that may have pineapple or red peppers or garlic in them to infuse flavor into generally vodka, sometimes done with tequila. Lately, you may have seen cherries in whiskeys or bourbons. It's called infusions. There is a provision in state law currently about altering or adulterating spirits that has made that practice technically illegal. We've met with the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Health, a wide variety of liquor interests who understand that that's obsolete.
The laws have been changed in many surrounding states. Iowa passed an infused spirits law in 2012. So the Section 2 makes infused spirits lawful. And it also allows cocktails to be made in advance. Technically, under state law, you can only combine spirits at the time they're ordered by a guest. That does not account. Some of you have seen sangria made in pitchers or margaritas made in advance or on Sunday mornings, perhaps Bloody Marys. That hasn't been lawful technically under Minnesota law, and this would change that. Now, there is an interesting, we've learned from other states that when allowing infused cocktails, it's important not to allow some ingredients that may make them less than good public policy. And that's the addition of pure caffeine, ginseng, or two vegetable ingredients I wasn't familiar with until I looked them up. And those are guarana and taurine. And guarana is a relative of coffee that has twice as much caffeine as coffee. It's popular in energy drinks, but it should not be in cocktails. Taurine is an amino acid that's also used in energy drinks. It's naturally occurring in seafood. It's derived from meat products, but it shouldn't be in cocktails, and so this would prohibit that. Other than that, it would allow pre-making cocktails like margaritas or Bloody Marys or the like. And so it makes relatively small changes in law. I hope we have done our homework and talked to a wide variety of interested parties, and we're not aware of any opposition, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we have a question from Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hoppe and Mr. McElroy, did you say caffeine and alcohol wouldn't be able to be mixed if we pass the Hoppe bill?
Madam Chair, there's... May I go ahead?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It would not prevent putting coffee, for example, or a Red Bull, which is lawful. What it would not permit is addition of pure caffeine. I went online. One can buy caffeine on Amazon, 100% pure pharmaceutical-grade caffeine, and it's not a good idea to mix that with alcohol, and particularly since it isn't obvious that it's there. If people, obviously many soft drinks like Mountain Dew or Mountain Dew Kickstart or Red Bull have large amounts of caffeine, but at least there's some moderation in what their original ingredients include. What we don't want is people buying caffeine by the pound and putting it into cocktails by the tablespoon.
And Madam Chair and Representative Hortman, Bailey's and coffee, for example, still legal.
Whiskey and Coke, still legal. Got it. Mm-hmm. Got it. My first thought was espresso martinis, but then I realized maybe there might be some more common drinks like Coke and whiskey that we would have to worry about. Thank you.
Any other questions for the members?
Samples?
I don't have that on my list.
I kind of like the espresso martini.
Seeing none, Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 2710 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Next up is Representative Lilly with House File 2444.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark is here.
We're going to have Representative Clark come up first. Sorry about that. And she asks, the chair moves that House File 2880 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Your
Madam
bill is
Chairman. Madam Chair, I do have one witness who I'd like to... Oh, here he is, right here.
Right.
Mr. Herman. Let me just very briefly describe what this bill does, and then I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Herman. Basically, what we're doing... someone needs to move the bill. I guess that's correct, right?
Yes. You're waiting for me to move it?
Well, or maybe Representative...
It's already been
like
moved.
Because I bumped him.
It's been moved.
Okay, thank you. So what this bill does, House Bill 2880 is basically kind of modernizes the statute as it affects the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and allows the one of their caterers or their caterers who work with them in the institute to actually evolve to another level of being able to serve alcohol there. And it also provides some language that has to do where that alcohol can be served. So I'm going to let Mr. Herman talk about that.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Herman. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis at the Fagree Law Firm, and I represent the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. The Art Institute has had a liquor license in the premises for almost 50 years, but a number of recent events have led them to look at their statute and realize that because it was passed so long ago, it's a little bit out of sync with all of the more recent statutes that have allowed liquor licenses in this type of zoning district in Minneapolis. So there are about, as you can see from the actual statute itself, there are about a dozen other special licenses for museums and similar venues. And the Art Institute is a bit unique, but basically everything in the bill is in law right now for one or another of the cultural institutions in the city of Minneapolis. What we realized was that we were limited to a single license. We've recently changed the restaurant concessionaire and coffee shop concessionaire, and so we had an issue come up about, you know, what is their license premises, and could they have two different licenses in the two spaces? We also have been considering doing a couple of other unique venues in the premises. As you all know, the Art Institute is more like a sports facility in that it's very large in size, has lots of different areas. We do catering in a totally different part of the building. So basically, as Representative Clark has said, what this does is it looks at these more recent authorizations for the Walker, the Swedish Institute, the Russian Museum, and some of the performance venues. It allows us to have multiple licenses in different parts of the facility. It deals with the compact and contiguous issue because inside the building they're not always compact and contiguous. And, of course, it's a local law, so the city will have to ultimately approve it as part of authorizing us to proceed in this fashion. So we hope the committee will be supportive.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Is there anyone else who cares to testify for or against this bill? Are there any questions from members? With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 2880 be laid over for possible inclusion of the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much,
committee members.
And finally, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly moves that House File 2440 be laid over for possible 2444 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill. Representative Lilly, let's hear about your bill. I'm curious.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pretty simple bill. If you look at it, they leave these sort of bills for me. They're quite short. I don't know if there'll be math, so we'll see if we get any math questions. But a couple of years ago in 2012, we opened up a beer at the Gopher football stadium, and they gave it a test, and it appears that it's been somewhat successful, and the university is interested in having it extended. And so it was a real bipartisan of effort in the first place to pass this, and it's really kind of neat that they're open to having it continue into the future. So I don't know where the math question, I suppose it could be 2 years future, first all the years in the future or something. So we'll stay tuned. But I have with me today Todd Iverson, and can kind of go through just briefly some of the things that we're looking at, and from the Chief of Staff, Ms. Yule, from the President's office. So we were going to invite Chair Atkins' sons from the Carlson School, but I guess they're studying or something. So.
Okay, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. My name is Todd Iverson, and I represent the university here at the legislature. I want to thank Representative Lilly for authoring the bill, the chair, and Representative Hoppe, and others that have worked on this issue for, quite frankly, probably far too long. 2 years ago, we did enter into a pilot program to see how well serving beer in the major seating bowl of TCF Bank Stadium would work. We were the first in the Big Ten to try this, and we took the chair's admonition to make this a fan-friendly experience very seriously, and we're happy to report that it's worked very well. The four slides that you have in front of you are from a board of report that was given to the Board of Regents earlier this winter, and I have Liz Yule from the President's office to quickly go through those four slides and just tell you a little bit about it. I am happy to report that on the last slide you will see that we have made money selling beer. That was an issue of that was raised last year, and we have accomplished that. So with that, Ms. Yule.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Liz Yule. I am Deputy Chief of Staff for Dr. Kaler in the Office of the President at the University of Minnesota. As Mr. Iverson said, these are four slides that we used from a larger packet we reviewed with the Board of Regents recently. We walked them through the public safety impacts, the neighborhood impacts, student experience and alcohol use on the Twin Cities campus, fan experience and the financial results. I'll get a little bit more detail on the public safety and the financial results in the last slides. And we did review, as I said, all of this and came to the conclusion that it is best for the institution to continue on as we have, which is to sell beer and wine in TCF Bank Stadium in both the general seating bowl and the premium areas, as well as continuing the sale of alcohol in the premium spaces of Mariucci and Williams Arena. On the second page, it just walks you quickly through our current procedures for selling beer and wine in TCF Bank Stadium. I'm not going to walk you through all the bullets, but one I would like to point out on the third one, for 2 years we have sold beer and wine in the general seating bowl via space in the West Plaza and outside of Gate A. When we begin hosting the Vikings this coming fall, they will be erecting bleachers in the West Plaza to accommodate a larger fan base than we accommodate in TCF Bank Stadium. And that will obviously displace our ability to sell in the West Plaza. The plan is to move the sale points of sales that would have been in the West Plaza now into the concourse itself. So we're working closely with the Vikings to do that. That's the one change moving forward. The next slide will give you a sense of public safety impact. Actually, during our pilot seasons, 12 and 13, our total incidents actually dropped, which other than the 2011 season. The police have been quite pleased with how this has played itself out in the venue, very comfortable with the ability that they have to manage the consumption of alcohol in that venue. And the final slide, as Mr. Iverson said, we wanted to show you that, in fact, we are making money. In the first year, the net profit was $21,000. There were a lot of upfront costs that were one time. And in the 2013 season, those obviously weren't there, and athletics made $181,000 net. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Yule. Is there anyone else who cares to testify before or against this bill? Are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, Representative Lilly moves or renews his motion that House File 2444 be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
With that, we are adjourned.